All right, thank you, Ms. Michelson. So the time is 8:31 a.m. on November 18, 2020. So I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Bohansky? Dr. Bohansky, you're muted. Dr. Bohansky, can you unmute yourself for roll call?
Present.
Thank you. Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. So let's see. Moving to item number 3 on the agenda, is there a motion to approve the regular session minutes of the October 14 Complaint Screening Committee meeting?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. There's a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed, so the motion passes. Moving on to item number 4 on the agenda, case discussion decision. I just wanted to give a heads up to everyone. My office building is testing their fire alarm system today, so I don't know, at some point it will start screeching, so I you all have been fairly warned. So I do wanted to mention a few preliminaries before going into the 3 cases on the agenda. The Complaint Screening Committee, according to Arizona Revised Statute Section 32-2081, subsection H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to any telephonic inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081, subsection H1. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda to review confidential records according to ARS 38-431.03, subsection A2, or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney according to subsection A3. Of ARS 38-431.03. A person or representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for those who speak. For those in attendance, please keep in mind that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon parties present and requests to speak. Please use only initials for patients or children. Keep in mind that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. The committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. So with those preliminaries in mind, I want to turn to the first case on the agenda, number T-20-08 for Carol Gandolfo. Since I'm the lead committee member on this case, I'll provide a brief overview of the complaint. So in May of 2020, the board moved to approve Dr. Gandolfo's license application for universal recognition. She was subsequently issued her Arizona psychologist license on May 14, 2020. On April 3rd of 2020, the board had voted to open an investigation to determine whether Dr. Gandolfo is practicing psychology in Arizona without a license. That is to say, the board voted to file a complaint with itself to investigate a potential violation of ARS 32-2084. The board received subpoenaed records from the Sedona Fire Department, where Dr. Gandolfo had been a mental health member of CISM, that is the Clinical Incident Stress Management, and a member of the critical incident team providing support to first responders. The only records available were 3 certificates of education completed by Dr. Gandolfo in 2017. To the board's complaint, Dr. Gandolfo responded as follows. Dr. Gandolfo has not assessed, diagnosed, or treated any patient in Arizona. She has been a licensed psychologist and marriage and family therapist in California for 20 years She's a licensed marriage and family therapist in Arizona with the Board of Behavioral Health. She has volunteered with the Sedona Police and Fire Departments. Her role is to assist in facilitating discussion among first responder peers in a group setting. Her role does not involve assessing, diagnosing, treating, or attempting to correct any mental health or behavioral illnesses or disorders. She serves as a volunteer board member with Bridges to Home, which is a California 501c3 nonprofit. Her role with the board does not involve the practice of psychology or delivery of psychology services in Arizona or anywhere else for that matter. Bridges to Home provides food to group homes for developmentally disabled young adults. She's designated as a mental health representative in her Bridges to Home bio, which does not involve, which does not violate ARS 32-2084, which prohibits use of words containing psych in it. Her LinkedIn profile does not claim she's licensed in Arizona. The US News and World Report article is someone else referring to Dr. Gandolfo as a clinical psychologist. So based on the foregoing, Dr. Gandolfo requests that the complaint be dismissed. In September, board staff had emailed some questions to Dr. Gandolfo regarding her business, CLG Behavior Consultants LLC. Dr. Gandolfo responded as follows. The LLC is a California entity. Her activities with the LLC involved a period when she held a psychologist license in California and related to consultation services to California-based institutional groups, not to patients. This completes my overview of the case. Ms. Michelson, do we have anyone signed up to speak in this matter?
As the committee is aware, this complaint was opened by the board, so there is no complainant, but I do believe that Dr. Gandolfo and her attorney, Mr. Riches, is present. I do not know if Mr. Cohen is here or not. I don't see him.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Good morning, Dr. Gandolfo. Good morning, Mr. Riches. If you wish to make a statement, you may do so. The committee may have questions for you or Dr. Gandolfo at this time. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Riches, and I represent Dr. Carol Gandolfo in this matter. As the chairman indicated, we've submitted a comprehensive written response to the board's complaint in this matter. In preparing that response, we provided as much information as we possibly could. We believe that written response and the voluminous materials we attached to it plainly show that there's been no unlawful practice in this case. We appreciate the board's thoughtful consideration of those written materials. For purposes of this brief introduction, I will just highlight a few points briefly, several of which the chairperson covered in his introduction. First, as the board is well aware, Dr. Gandolfo has been a licensed psychologist and marriage family therapist in the state of California for over two decades. She is also a licensed psychologist and marriage family counselor in the state of Arizona. She has vast experience in both fields, an impressive resume, and has never been the subject of any disciplinary action or complaints over that very long period of time. She is, quite simply, an experienced and respected mental health professional. The allegations that gave rise to this complaint were the result of a newspaper article, an email Dr. Gandolfo sent to the board, and Dr. Gandolfo's LinkedIn profile. Highlighting those issues very briefly and beginning with the U.S. News and World Report article, the allegation in the complaint, as far as we could discern, is that Dr. Gandolfo used the designation psychologist, reportedly in violation of ARS 32-2084. Dr. Gandolfo did not use that designation. A reporter did. It is not the law that anything a third party uses, anytime a third party uses a name or a phrase, then that use is imputed to another person. And in any event, Dr. Gandolfo was a psychologist and had been for nearly two decades at the time that article was written. She did not refer to herself as a psychologist. In fact, the report did not to refer to her as an Arizona psychologist. So that one is plainly easily just dispatched with. Next is the service as a volunteer board member of Bridges to Home. As the chairman indicated, Bridges to Home is a 501c3 nonprofit. That entity is incorporated in California, where, again, Dr. Gandolfo is licensed. Of course, the board has no jurisdiction over a California entity or its activities. In any event, those activities did not involve the practice of psychology at all. They were, the entity's activities were essentially limited to providing food to group homes for developmentally disabled young adults, as the executive director director's affidavit makes clear, which we appended to our written response. The next item is the LinkedIn profile. It refers to Dr. Gandolfo as a licensed psychologist from July 1998 to November 2009. That is, of course, factually correct. She was a licensed psychologist in the state of California during those dates, and of course, still is. The fourth item is the email about CLG. CLG provided consulting services to California-based homes located entirely within the state of California. Again, the board does not have jurisdiction over a California-based entity. The consulting services were not the practice of psychology. And of course, psychology focuses on the location of the recipient of the services, not on the provider. Again, the evidence plainly establishes there's no unlawful practice with respect to that issue. Finally, Dr. Gandolfo's volunteer activities with the Sedona police and fire departments, as the many affidavits make clear, Dr. Gandolfo's activities with these departments did not involve or even closely approach the practice of psychology. For the police department, she helped with evidence transport, fingerprinting, and crowd control. For fire, she participated on a CISM team, which is expressly a non-diagnostic group-based discussion resource for public safety personnel. It is the equivalent of something like Alcohol Anonymous, but in other types of peer-to-peer support groups. The overwhelming evidence that we appended to our response establishes that in Dr. Gandolfo's limited volunteer activities on the CISM team, they did not involve any mental health services whatsoever. She never used or insinuated the use of a psychologist designation, and that is plainly supported by the testimony under oath of the witnesses who provided statements regarding that issue. Based on our review of the investigative report, there was no additional evidence or information the board has received that shows that Dr. Gandolfo was or is engaged in the unlawful practice of psychology. On the contrary, the overwhelming evidence provided by Dr. Gandolfo herself supports a finding that she plainly was not. This committee should vote to find that there has been no unlawful practice in this case and should close this matter at the earliest opportunity. We're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Riches. Do any of the committee members have questions to ask Mr. Riches or Dr. Gandolfo?
Chairman Leinor?
Yes, Dr. Meyer, please.
Thank you for being here. Dr. Gandolfo, when you were providing consultation, interacting with your company back in California, were you at any time providing clinical supervision to staff or discussing client matters?
So the board did, I believe, receive my written letter regarding this matter. We've asked the board to take a position with respect to its jurisdiction over California-based entities. We've also asked the board to state its position regarding whether providing consulting services to institutional entities located outside the state of Arizona would violate the rule.
I understand what you said, but Arizona law says that providing psychology services across state lines requires that you be licensed in Arizona as well as the state where the client resides. So
I'm sorry, what law is that? We could not find any law or regulation that
Dr. Gandolfo should be aware of that now that she's licensed psychologist in Arizona. It's a state statute. But my question stands is, with her business that provided psychological services, did she ever provide supervision to those staff or discuss client information?
I've advised Dr. Gandolfo not to provide any additional information until the board takes a position on whether or not the practice of psychology occurs where the entity is located or where a provider is located. We have a right under Title 41 and the Regulatory Bill of Rights to have any licensing decision be specifically based on statute or rule. We asked for that statute or rule and none was provided. So our position at this point is until that reference can be provided, I can't properly advise my client on this issue.
All right, so I will look it up for you.
Ms. Galvin, can you help out Dr. Meyer if you can?
I'm looking as well and pulling the reference.
So it would be under, let's see, Title IV, Professions and Occupations, Chapter 26, Board of Psychologist Examiners, Article 1, General Provisions, and then it falls under R4-26-109 through 110 and 111. R4-26-111 focuses on providing supervision through telepractice. So that is what I'm referencing.
We did ask for any of these materials in September, on September 24th, and none was provided.
These are the psychology rules, and Dr. Gandolfo is required to know them for licensure here in Arizona. There's also a memo on the board website further explaining telepsychology services. So is it my understanding that you don't want to answer if she provided supervision or clinical consultation to clients in California?
My answer to the question is that I cannot properly advise my client on this issue in the absence of a clear rule or regulation that governs. We requested that information over a month and a half ago, and it wasn't provided. To the extent the board has that, we would be happy to review it and provide a response after we have fair notice of any alleged allegations.
Okay, that's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. Is there any other question? Hearing none, the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note that the deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, respondent, or attorneys representing respondents. Since I'm the lead member, I will begin the deliberation. I don't see a violation of 2084. That was the complaint that was issued against by the board against Dr. Gandolfo. And so we have to stay kind of within the four corners of the complaint. If the complaint had included, some of these other things that Dr. Meyer mentioned, then, that would have been the scope of the investigation and the evidence that is before us. But as far as I'm concerned, the complaint, the four corners of the complaint only alleged a potential violation of 32-2084. So given that directive, and remember, this was in the April 3rd meeting, it was the full board that had voted to open this investigation, and they had listed only this provision in the complaint. So based on that complaint, our board staff investigated any potential violations as to only 2084, and we have, I think, evidence in front of us with respect to that. In terms of the complaint before us, I would be inclined to dismiss it. If Dr. Meyer or anyone else, since an individual board member can put, I would assume, an item on the agenda for the next full board meeting's consideration, I can, maybe that's the route you want to take, Dr. Meyer, I don't know, but.
This still falls under 2084. The question is, was she practicing psychology? And their argument that we don't have jurisdiction over California. Well, we have jurisdiction if she's practicing psychology while she's located in Arizona. and so if she was physically here, regardless of where the client was, if it's in another state, then we do have jurisdiction over that. And that's been the whole contention, was she practicing psychology while in Arizona? and that would include providing telepsychology across state lines. So I do believe it falls under the current scope of examination. And I went back over everything. I did not see any mention of psychology or psychologist. The two main concerns for me was mental health representative, and the further explanation from the Sedona Fire Department that it's peer support. I mean, I think it's a very fine line, because she's not just a peer, she's the mental health representative, and that she facilitates peer-to-peer interaction. To me, that sounds like psychological services. She's not acting as a peer, she's acting as a facilitator of group therapy or group peer support. Peer support, like Alcoholics Anonymous, is solely peers. There's no mental health facilitator. So that is still questionable to me based on the information that they've provided. And then in addition, when she provided more information about the services, her company in California, the consultation services, it's unclear to me whether she was practicing psychology or not. If she was providing clinical supervision, to clinical staff and or discussing client topics, or giving recommendations on how to proceed with services for a client, then she was providing supervision, which is practice of psychology. So I see that there's the potential violation here.
Any other discussion?
Dr. Bohansky?
Yes, Dr. Bob, please.
It's not a question for me of whether it's good work. I think that the more peer support, consultation, assistance that our profession can provide, the better. The question for me is whether or not this is another one of these across state line type of, what do I want to say here? Attempts to avoid the regulatory process of practicing across state lines by using different terms. Peer support, mental health professional, mental health kind of assistance. We've crafted in Arizona methods to practice across state lines, SciPac and ePassport and different ways that people can appropriately practice across state lines and do that in a way that there is clarity between the boards. California board will handle this, the Arizona board will handle that. We can protect the public in our state, they can protect the public in their state. And we try, I think, very hard to come up with ways to deconflict those kind of issues and make sure that our folks are doing what is appropriate. Thus, we put the burden on our folks to know, as Dr. Meyer points out, what the appropriate rules are that govern their practice within our state lines, as well as when they cross state lines to provide services. When you provide services as an Arizona psychologist, you're required to follow those guidelines. And I'm in agreement with Dr. Meyer that there appears to be a lack of attention to those rules as they apply in this case.
Thank you, Dr. Bohansky. So looking at R4-26-109, I believe it says a licensee who provides psychological services or supervision. And By definition, 2084 applies to those who are not licensed in Arizona. So I'm confused, Dr. Meyer, what your specific allegation is as to how the telepractice rules apply to someone who is not a licensee in the situation that we have in front of us. So I just want to be sure that we are very careful in asserting jurisdiction in these kinds of cases.
If I may, this is Jean Galvin. I think Dr. Meyer's point is that if you're going to be providing telehealth services across state lines, you have to be licensed. His point is that the 2084 is applicable because it appears that she is practicing, I'm paraphrasing what he says, without a license. His reference to 109 and 110 simply was in response to Mr. Ritchie's question about whether someone had to be licensed if they are providing services across state lines.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin. I agree.
All right. Is there any further discussion? Yes, Dr. Bohansky.
I'm sorry, I was coughing.
Oh, sorry.
So I would make a motion that we move this to the full board for examination of a possible violation of what? ARS 32-2084.
And I would second it with a comment. In this COVID age, in which we're having more and more practice across state lines, and there is a continual, what I believe is need for practice across state lines, I'd like to move this to the full board for clarification, because we're going to have more and more cases like this. And I think this is an ample opportunity for us to really come to some closure with this and get some clarity on it, because it's becoming an increasing practice and issue for us today.
All right, there is a motion and a second.
If I may, so Dr. Bohansky, I want to be clear that the motion is to move this matter to the full board. Yes. Against Dr. Gandolfo for possible violation of 32-2084. You support that motion? Yes. And in addition, you're stating that you wish the board would take a look at, in the age of COVID, telepractice in general. But you do support the motion to move this to the full board as it relates to Dr. Gandolfo.
Yes, Attorney Galvin, that's my position, and I'm trying to be as fair as I can, and I'm trying to get as much guidance as I can, and I think that as we proceed into unfathomed waters of the next 6 months of this COVID thing and increased cases, I'd really like to know where we stand on this, what's the right position to take, because it's important that we not have things go haywire.
And is there any information that the committee would like to request from Dr. Gandolfo?
I think we need to know what her, what services she provided to her company and as consultation services. Mm-hmm. When she was located in Arizona.
I agree with Dr. Myers, is that what were the services being provided? Were those services appropriate under our statute? And if we need to change our statute and make things more appropriate, that's a whole nother discussion for a further board meeting. But I certainly want to patch whatever hole we have here.
All right, there is a motion and a second. Ms. Michelson, will you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Bohansky?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
No.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson.
So this matter will proceed to an initial case review before the board at a future meeting date, and staff will be in contact with Dr. Gandolfo and her attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Riches. Thank you, Dr. Gandolfo. So the next complaint on the agenda is 21-03 for Robert Mastikian. Dr. Bohansky, since you're the lead committee member, will you please provide the committee with an overview?
Yes, sir. Thank you. This is a complaint similar to one which was reviewed by this board in the past. It involves Robert McCakin's ID, license number 4473. The brief substance of this is a consultation report which was created by the licensee, having interviewed one partner in a domestic dispute over custody, and that non-court ordered consultation that was provided to the court with information based solely upon interview with the father in this case. Mother is the complainant and reports, as she has in the past, that the consultation summary, which was submitted to the court, was full of misinformation. Based on the fact that this is connected to a prior consultation, I would ask for legal advice in executive session, and so move.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Seconded.
Thank you. There's a motion and a second. All in favor to go into executive session for legal advice, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed, motion passes. So what's going to happen is, I think Ms. Michelson is going to have a breakout room, if I'm not mistaken. And then we can all, just the board members, Ms. Galvin, and board staff, will go into executive session. Everyone else, please just remain within the Zoom. And Hansky, do you want to continue to provide an overview, or have you finished providing your overview? You're muted, Dr. Bohansky. Dr. Bob, you're still muted.
I'm sorry. Can we hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. This is a complaint that was filed following the development of a consultation summary provided to the husband in these proceedings, which has then been used in a family court process. In this consultation summary, the doctor appeared to present evidence against the wife, including diagnostic statements, beliefs about her mental health history, and essentially her need for evaluation. This was done unilaterally. This was no consultation with the wife in this proceeding. And as a result, this consultation sheet with some information believed by the wife following her review of it to be extremely misleading, if not false, full of accusations and poor history. The question here arises as to whether it's appropriate for a psychologist to do a one-side evaluation and provide information that may be less than accurate, and whether or not providing such a service like that is helpful. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my summary, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Dr. Bohansky. Ms. Michelson, has anyone requested to speak regarding this matter?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I believe the complainant, KP, is present, as well as Dr. Mastikian and his attorney, so we can start with KP.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. KP, could you please speak up and state your initials only for the record? you may make a statement at this time, and the committee members may have questions to ask you. You may proceed when you're ready.
Provide a couple of brief statements. I never had any kind of correspondence, never spoke with, never met with this psychologist. He never substantiated any of his claims from my ex-husband. And this report has been brought up in court. It's been brought up in a number of court filings. It's been brought up in independent psychological examinations that have been undertaken because of family court. It's been used as a collateral to determine my mental health condition, to determine I need to go through these independent psychological examinations. And the list has gone on and on what this report has been used for. And the vast majority of the information in that report is not accurate.
All right. Do any of the committee members have questions to ask Ms. Capey?
Yes, I do.
Dr. Bob, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Capey, how did you become aware of this report?
It was brought up in court, and it was brought up in court filing.
And prior to it being brought up in court, were you aware of it being completed at all?
No, the first time I saw it was with some court filing.
Do you know what the purpose of this report was?
The purpose was to use this in court to try to help, my ex-husband, in the court process, family court process.
Have you undergone a psychological evaluation at all?
I have just completed one by Dr. Shally, and Dr. Buwald is in the process of completing one against my ex-husband. I haven't received the results of that, but one of the reasons opposing counsel wanted to do this independent psychological examination was because of this report. Obviously, these psychological, evaluations were having to get performed by the court are thousands and thousands of dollars, not to mention the legal fees and everything related to court fees.
Regarding this report, which is a brief report, were you contacted at all during the preparation of that report?
I was not contacted at all, no.
Without mentioning diagnosis by title, is there information in this report that you view to be false, inaccurate, or misleading?
Absolutely.
What information?
I mean, pretty much most of this report, I have it pulled up right now. This is a 3-page report, and the vast majority of this is just simply not true. The last paragraph says there appears to be enough evidence to conclude that Mrs. Polkerbeck may have an underlying trauma condition, which may be contributing to her periodic mood fluctuations, her extremely controlling behaviors.
KP, if I may interrupt, I don't see Ms. Galvin here, but I'm a bit concerned that the paragraph that she's attempting to read may have some confidential information. Ms. Galvin, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's in the public domain because it was filed in court. And I think her point, KP's point, is that the information she's reading is false and does not apply to her.
That helps. Yeah, thank you, Ms. Galvin. Sorry to interrupt you, Ms. KP, you may proceed with your statement.
Okay. Yes, and I am absolutely claiming that, these things are not true that I'm reading. I just read the mood fluctuation controlling behaviors. You know, continuing on just this one paragraph, she was reportedly sexual assaulted right before they met, which is not true. To the best of his knowledge, has not addressed her trauma in a therapeutic setting. She has an extremely distinct personality, which has not ever been found before, which suggests she has a very dichotomous way of thinking, behaving, and reacting, all of which could be signs of borderline personality disorder. Not true. This possible personality disorder may have its foundation in her untreated trauma history and may have developed a response to have an absentee father. Again, not true, who she resented for nearly 15 years. You know, as such, it's strongly recommended that she complete a more comprehensive psychological evaluation to assess for PTS condition, borderline personality disorder. You know, so that's just a sample. I mean, I could read all three pages. I could provide this, and basically it's just all the same thing, a bunch of untrue statements.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, KP. Thank you, Dr. Bohansky. Are there any other questions from Ms. KP?
If I could just have the staff note, I believe Ms. KP inadvertently stated her name on the recording. Can we ensure that that is removed from the recording?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gavin. So hearing no questions for KP, let's move on with Dr. Mastikian. And I believe his attorney is present. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Ms. Natalia Sturgrigorian.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. You may wish to make a statement at this time, or if not, the committee members may just have questions to ask you or Dr. Mastikian at this point. So you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you so much. Yes, I would like to make a very brief statement. And if for some reason my telephonic connection isn't good, please feel free to interrupt and yell at me and let me know. Good morning, members of the board. First, I would like to thank you for allowing us to participate this morning remotely. And like I indicated, we would like to a brief statement and then answer any questions the board members may have. Dr. Mastikian and I for this board in October of 2019 to address the very same issue that is raised in the complaint was filed by KP. And after that hearing in October 2019, the board dismissed the complaint, concluding that Dr. Mastikian did not violate any rule or statute or guideline by issuing a consultation summary without an examination, because that is what the APA permits psychologists to do, is to issue a consultation summary without performing a personal independent examination, so long as the resulting summary or report contains the limiting language qualifying the report. And that's what this report, it is contained, information. It clearly apprised the reader that this was not to be used as a diagnostic tool, and there were no diagnoses in the report. It was simply a report that essentially identified potential mental conditions that were consistent with the reported behaviors. And the report also indicated very explicitly that AP was the source of information. So that is, I think, worthy of noting. But even though the board dismissed that 2019 complaint altogether, immediately after the board hearing, Dr. Mastikian did the following two things out of a sincere commitment to maintain a practice that really satisfied the ethical standards, actually address the concerns articulated by the board and address the board's comments. So after that October 2019 meeting, Dr. Mastikian went back and he revised the report that was this consultation summary, I should say, that was issued after meeting with AP to further reiterate and make it abundantly clear that this was not a diagnostic tool and that information came solely from AP. One of the things also that I want to, based on kind of the summary of this case, is that while the consultation may have been submitted with a court filing, there is nothing to indicate that it was ever admitted as an exhibit in any evidentiary hearing. We just have a document indicating that it was a potential exhibit for a hearing. And we know based on KP's communication discussions with the board that she voluntarily agreed to a psychological evaluation. So there was never an instance where the court relied on this consultation summary to order KP to undergo, you know, an evaluation. She voluntarily agreed to do that. And it's also worth noting that another competent doctor and psychologist, Dr. John Shalley, also found, based on his review of the available documents, that additional psychological testing was warranted. And it's my understanding that Dr. Shalley also did not personally examine P prior to issuing that August 3rd, 2020 letter. So in addition to revising the consultation, Dr. Masekin also elected to just discontinue this portion of his practice altogether. And this, of course, occurred prior to the incident complaint being filed. So we have an instance where Dr. Masekin engaged in conduct that this board has already determined did not violate any ethical standard or guideline or any board statute. But then he went back and proactively, voluntarily made changes based on the board's comments. And so to us, it appears that dismissal of the incident complaint is also appropriate. No harm to any member of the public. Just as KP denies the allegations in the report, the information that was available to Dr. Masekin indicated otherwise. And there's no way really with the context of today's meeting to ascertain whether or not anything in the consultation summary was, true or untrue. But we do know that Dr. Masekin, first of all, was careful to indicate that these were the allegations made by AP. He never definitively made any statements about KP, and he never made a diagnosis of KP. And so we would like to ask that the board dismiss this complaint, just as the 2019 action addressing the same issue was dismissed, based on the fact that the APA authorizes psychologists to perform consultations and issue these opinions without doing an independent examination. And also because there was no harm to the public. In fact, one of the reasons the CTN initially agreed to perform this consultation was because there was a child with a genetic disorder who was part of this family law proceeding. And really one of the purposes of any family proceeding is to ensure the well-being of the child or the child. So this report was something to assist the court in making decisions that were children's best interest. And other mental health professionals similarly agreed that additional psychological testing and evaluation was warranted to determine whether there was an issue that would affect mother's parenting ability.
Thank you.
Board members?
Are there any questions? Yeah. Are there any questions for Mr. Gregorian or for Dr. Masekin?
Sure, I've got a couple. And I certainly am in favor when a child's welfare is at risk that we make good decisions. And sometimes those involve evaluations. My question is for the doctor.
Yes, Dr. Bransky.
Good morning. If you could speak up a little, I could barely hear you.
Can you hear me now?
A little louder, please.
Yes, sir.
We need the Verizon commercial on.
No, good morning. I'll speak louder, please.
Yes. And I know that the complainant focused on the third paragraph or the last paragraph of the last page, and I'm going to do something like that as well. To the general public, the court system, the legal system, which is what we often write our reports to, our language can be interpreted in a multitude of ways. The language in your last sentence or two concerns me. While you note that this is a possible, and it's in the public record, so I'll go ahead and say it, personality disorder. You're suggesting that that personality disorder could be the founded in untreated trauma, but the only evidence you may have for any trauma, if it existed, comes not from the patient, comes from a third party. And then you go on to suggest that it may have developed in response to having an absentee father. But again, without interviewing the client, the relationship with father is a question. The potential cause of absentee fatherism on someone's condition is a question. And the fact that she may have resented this absentee father comes purely from another source. While I can certainly agree with the recommendation that there be a psychological evaluation, drawing conclusions as to how someone's condition may have came about is a little far-fetched for me. As I'm sure you're aware, someone's reaction to the stressors of the world can certainly be caused by a myriad of things of which you don't know in this case. And I think that if you're to make guesses there, the list of guesses about what could have or may not have happened, because we don't know, would be rather lengthy. So I'm a bit concerned that this stuff was pulled out, presented almost as if it were fact. And I'm sure it could be read by the court, could be read by non-behavioral health folks involved in decision making as accurate, factual, and in fact damning of the one party. Do you see that language as a problem?
In hindsight, yes. When we go back to the last time we met, I believe you made the comment about the same thing about the language from the prior consultation summary that I had completed. I took that into consideration immediately after, and I revised all of the remainder of my consultation reports to take that strong language out and keep it a little more benign, and which is what I did. And I submitted a revised version of this consultation summary to the attorney the day after we met with the board, and that was submitted. And it was we asked for the attorney to immediately replace the prior consultation, which is the consultation in question now, with the revised report with the less intrusive language. And I agreed with you then, and I agree with you now.
Okay, thank you.
Of course.
Chairman, this is Dr. Meyer.
Yes, Dr. Meyer.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for being here, Dr. Mastikian. Couple of concerns I have as well. You brought up the previous case that we saw, but that was brought by, I believe, a judge, whereas this one is being brought by the complainant that you are talking about but did not review. And when your attorney says that there was no harm to the public, we have an allegation that there was harm to that. So can you address that, please?
Would you like me to address it or my attorney to address that?
Whoever. My concern is that your statements, the very strong language, the suggesting that there are diagnoses, I believe you said you strongly suggest, and almost no, I understand your revisions were good, that you were much more clear about the source, but this first one that went out says almost nothing other than you interviewed by phone the
now ex-husband, but there's no qualifications of that. And the claimant is saying she was harmed by this. So what's your response to that?
Dr. Meyer, if I may quickly respond, can you hear me?
Yes.
Excuse me. Dr. Meyer is asking Dr. Mastikian to respond to the question. I think it's most appropriate, unless you're going to make yourself a fact witness, that Dr. Mastikian respond.
Can I ask who was speaking just now?
This is Jean Galvin, the board's attorney.
Okay.
Okay.
I thought the question was for either of us, but I'll refrain.
Dr. Meyer, would you mind repeating the question?
Yeah, sorry, I rambled there a bit. Your attorney said for you that there was no harm to the public. And I'm questioning that because we have a complainant this time saying that she was directly harmed by your report. So my question is, do you feel that your report caused any harm to the public, to the claimant?
I'll say this. The main reason why I performed the consultation was because the now ex-husband made it very clear that he had very big concerns about his special needs son, and who has Prader-Willi syndrome. And so when I took on the consultation, and again, I have a history of working with DCS, and I took the lens that I would use to do everything I can to protect the child. I took on all the information from the father with the intention of making sure that this child is safe. And it sounds as if my truly altruistic intention of making sure this child was safe inadvertently possibly harmed the mother. But I made it very clear in the report, the original report, which I again revised because of the board's direction, to take out that strong language and put in a lot more, you know, softer language to make sure the point comes across, while at the same time, you know, not making it as diagnostically, you know, directive, if that makes any sense. Just to push the fact that, yes, I do have concerns about the child's safety in this case, as did the father, and everything the father said was the potential that the mother was the person that he was concerned about. Again, I learned a lot from the last board meeting, and I have not done any of these reports since then. And everything I've done with other consultation summaries, which do not involve family court, I've modified everything in my mindset, the way I approach the reports, and so forth. So it was a valuable lesson the last time. So I'm hoping that matters.
Are there other consultations? This is the second one we've seen now. Are there other consultations that you did that are similar to this?
All of them have been revised. My understanding is that two of them have already gone to court, and I don't believe there. I haven't heard anything about any other problems, and I'm knocking on wood for that.
Okay. Final question is, the other thing that was mentioned in your statement is that according to APA ethical guidelines, that at times it's appropriate to conduct an evaluation without meeting with the individual of interest. The way I read that is if you do not have access, cannot get access, and you're expected to explain the attempts that you took to obtain additional information, or in regards to when you're reviewing records about someone and providing an evaluation, never about just pulling information from someone that may not be objective. So I'm really struggling to see how you could provide any of this information without seeking to verify any of it or to provide any kind of opinions, which is what it looks like you're doing, with no knowledge about that person. Do we disagree on how the APA ethics code reads to that, or explain to me how it's okay to provide this information about someone that you have no information about?
Do you want me to address that?
Please.
Okay. First of all, when the attorney that the father was using, they sent me a couple of these referrals for a consultation. We always ask for records to be sent in addition to the request from the parent to come in for the consultation evaluation, I'm sorry, the consultation, or to do it telephonically. We never received any records for this claimant, this person, the father. We requested it a second time. We never got anything back. If I go back to my experiences doing, working as a unit consultant for the Department of Child Safety, primarily my understanding of how we, interpret the APA rules, I use that mentality. And when I worked that understanding of it, and as I was working with the department, I would be provided with a summary by the case manager, and they would provide, sometimes provide records, sometimes they would not provide records. And then, based on that, I would provide an opinion about what should be the next step. And then the department would provide that information to the court system. And then, testing or an evaluation would be recommended if it's appropriate. That was my understanding of and my interpretation of the APA rule. I don't think I'm the only one that understands it that way. Obviously, we all have. I know many colleagues who are unit consultants and who do the same work. But again, my lesson learned in this is that different realms of doing this type of work, there are different kind of rules of play. And, in hindsight, I've learned a lot from the last meeting. And again, I'm not doing these types of consultations anymore because I'm not guaranteed that I'm going to be able to get records from the attorney. And then this is possibly what can occur. And I don't want to harm anybody, obviously. With this case particularly, I just wanted to make sure this child was okay. The father had genuine concerns. That's the way I interpreted it. And so I went ahead and performed the consultation. If I've never been asked by any of the attorneys that I've worked with to speak to the other side. Again, this was uncharted territory for me. So I was like, anytime the attorney referred somebody to me, I would have that person come in and we would do the consultation. I've never been asked by the department to interview the person that they're asking me to, they're asking me for a consultation for either. So, I don't know how else to answer that question, honestly.
Dr. Bohansky.
I'm going to slide in here and say, I believe the altruism that you want what's in the best interest of the child. You wouldn't be in this business doing this number of things if you weren't of that ilk and belief. There's a difference, however, in saying what's in the best interest of this child is that this parent and this environment or this living situation should be evaluated, which I believe is an appropriate thing for a psychologist to say. There's a difference between that and trying to justify that recommendation based upon a lack of of information and assumptions that are made as to what the behavior is, what causing behavior, is there behavior there? All we have to say is there's behavior that's of concern potentially, and an evaluation to clarify this is appropriate. And that's your role. It's straightforward. Coming up with the story, the backstory, which is what you appear to do, is come up with a backstory. And I think on what Dr. Meyer's point is your backstory is harmful to the mom in this situation, is that she views this as less than accurate, less than worked out, less than understood information that's harmful to her as a person. It may be harmful to her in her role with her child. It may be harmful to her in some way that that neither of us know about. But that by creating that potential backstory, and by the way, your backstory may be right. I don't know that, she doesn't know that, or we don't know that. But by creating the backstory as justification, rather than the simple justification I gave you, is what Dr. Meyer, I believe, is referring to as, here's someone who feels harmed by this backstory and believes this document, as many of them do, that get into the system is going to be potentially harmful for times to come for her. And that's why we're here today, is it harms people when we do things in this fashion.
I agree, and my sincerest apologies to the mother, truly. And I mean that, not just because we're here today. My intentions were not to hurt her. I understand from the board's perspective, from Dr. Meyer and Dr. Bohansky, from the last time we spoke about this, and which is why I have since changed everything in terms of language. And I took it to heart, even though I wasn't ordered to do anything. I really understood it, and it made a lot of sense to me. And even after we left the last meeting, I've done nothing but keep cognizant of my language when it comes down to even full reports, not let alone consultation summaries and so forth. And again, I did everything I could to take the board's language, which again, I truly understood and took to heart, and modify whatever else evaluations that I had or consultations that I had to make sure that this was done properly with the board's direction, which again, I totally agree with and makes sense.
This is KP. May I interject?
Briefly, if you want to make a statement.
Okay, this revised version, I've never seen a revised version. It was the original report. It was admitted into court. It was only the original report used for, you know, the court-appointed advisor and independent psychological examinations and things like that. I've never seen, or the revised version has never been used.
Members of the board, this is Natalia Chergogorian. Could I respond to that brief?
Yes, please.
If you look in the board's file, we know that Dr. Shally reviewed the revised October 30th, 2019 report. It's listed on, let me see here, let me track down the page. It's listed as one of the documents he reviewed on page one that showed that he reviewed the family court consultation summary revised October 30th, 2019. By Dr. Mostikian. So, and like I said, based on the record that was provided to the board, it's unclear whether the original report was ever admitted as an exhibit. I understand they may have been filed with the court, but it was never relied on by the court to order any evaluation. KP voluntarily agreed to that.
Right. And the reason that I voluntarily agree was because my attorney told me that it would just be a waste of time and money in family court to try to get out of the evaluation, even when there may be no mental concerns present.
Mr. Chergogorian, do you want to respond to that statement by Ms. KP?
Yes, I would, Your Honor. So, I'm sorry, board members. So,
that she voluntarily agreed to the evaluation is not an indicator of anything that was, you know, her decision based on consultation with her attorney to agree to the evaluation based on the report cannot be attributed to Dr. Mastikian when she's also trying to assert that the court relied on this report to her detriment when she voluntarily made the decision to undergo a psychological evaluation. And also I would note that even the original report that was submitted or may have been filed with the court, even that report contained qualifying language. I think even a board member may have indicated earlier that there was the word strongly in that paragraph on page 3, but even that was in reference to it's recommended that there be further a further psychological examination or an evaluation or further testing. It was not that there was a strong indication of mental health conditions or diagnoses. So I just wanted to make that distinction. I think the recommendation in that original report, it was clear in the report that the only source consulted was AP. It was clear from the report that, you know, all the language in that paragraph was framed as according to the information Dr. Mastikian had available to him, which was the information provided by AP. Here is there's a basis for further evaluation or further testing. And Dr. Shally, I did the same after reviewing the information available to him. I would just say that based on the fact that the APA code does authorize, I understand that there's some difference of opinion in terms of when an individual examination is required. But according to the language of that APA, it says that an individual examination is only when necessary or warranted. And when you don't have an individual examination, and that is made clear in the subsequent consultation summary report that says, hey, this is not a diagnosis and there was no individual examination, I do believe that that complies with the standards enunciated or articulated in the APA.
Thank you for the response. Do the committee members have any further questions to ask Dr. Mastikian? Hearing none, the committee will now begin deliberations. Please keep in mind that the deliberation is the time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without any interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing the licensees. Dr. Bohansky, since you're the lead member, would you please begin the deliberation?
You're muted, Dr. Bohansky.
You're muted, Dr. Bohansky.
Thank you. I am now unmuted.
There you are.
I'd be happy to go ahead and start. I'm not the lead board member on this, but I have some thoughts. We take on a grave responsibility when it involves children. There are a few psychologists that we have left in town who are willing to take on such an important task. In doing so, in advocating for the child, we often may be viewed as somehow seeing the parents as secondary, as at fault, as guilty, as ill, as something. And we have to struggle to keep in mind that the parents, in fact, are the best therapists for this child. They're the ones that are going to be closest. They're the ones that are going to be working with this child, despite their foibles and problems and issues and concerns, of which there are many, the more involved that the child's condition is. We have an opportunity to make recommendations, and that's huge.
Someone is at the front
and
door.
And we should be making those recommendations in the best interest of the child. Hold, excuse me a second. Oh.
Front door doesn't support that.
You're muted, Dr. Bohansky.
Sorry. As such, a parent or interested party may come forward and tell us they have a concern. And we should listen to that concern. And we should take that concern seriously. But we have to be careful in taking that concern seriously that the next recommendation we make doesn't compromise another strength or resource in that child's inventory. And in this case, it's a mom. And I don't know mom's background. I don't know her history. I don't know any of those things that were assumed, alleged, thought to justify the evaluation. The justification for the evaluation is the child themselves. The justification for the evaluation is finding the appropriate strengths, the appropriate resources that are going to support this child. And that's the way these things should be listed. Not that mom may have X, Y, or Z going on with her. Hell, everybody could have X, Y, or Z going on with her. That's not the issue here. The issue here is let's find the best resource. Let's find where the strengths are. Let's find where the deficits are so we can build the best support for this child, period. And if doctor will stick to that type of language, I would agree with his attorney that there will be situations that APA agrees with in which we make a recommendation like that. It's a harmless recommendation that a further evaluation be conducted. What's not harmless is when we make the recommendation based upon a backstory that we create from someone's limited information to us. And we want to be careful of that. If there's an error, that's where the error is, in my humble estimation. But again, we're here to protect not just this child. We're here to protect those other people involved, and that includes the mom. And in this case here, mom felt harmed, and I think for good reason. So I'll stop there. Those are my thoughts.
And I would agree with all of that, Dr. Bohansky. I think that there was a confusion in roles where previously working for or with DCS and then stepping over to an independent evaluator, even if there was a focus on the child, that was not your role, or that was not his role. That of course, anytime we see concern, we need to act about protecting a child, but there's a legal process for doing that in these custody situations. And this was outside of his previous responsibilities is my guess. And I think that Dr. Mastikian was very responsive to the last time we saw him for the same issues as far as the report goes, and attempted to address those concerns. So I don't know what else we would actually require of him to do at this point. That being said, I think that there's a violation here, and that the claimant understandably has concerns and potentially harmed from this. And so I do see an ethical violation that needs to be addressed.
So do I hear a motion, or is there any further discussion?
I'd like to have a little bit further discussion.
Sure.
And Dr. Meyer and I agree, I think 99% of the time on what we're seeing here. The ethical violation to me is right on the edge. It's right on the edge. And I want to be very careful in terms of what a remedy might be for this. I find that the role the doctor was performing with DCS prior. We've seen these cases before. They do the work that way. When he slid into private practice, perhaps he got a little enthusiastic about his advocacy role. Is the ethical violation in using that advocacy role to an extreme, to the detriment of a client by not including them, by not picking up the phone and making a phone call for the other side of the story? Is the ethical violation in relying upon this one-sided approach that seems to be acceptable in some situations? When the doctor is very responsive to the cure and in fact has revised, and I don't know if this one slipped through, we haven't asked that question. How was it that this didn't get revised until it was complained? But it was this part of a list of consultations he was going through and fixing to come back into what I would call good graces with those reports? How did this one slip through? Was this one done after our meeting? It was done before. He's shaking his head. So somehow this one got through the gates and wasn't revised, or when it was revised, the complainant wasn't aware of it and all she saw was the first one. But something happened there if you're in the process of curing something and fixing it and someone complains about what's being fixed, is that an ethical violation? When I've seen what I've done, I've admitted what I've done wrong, I've taken it to heart, I've gone ahead and done the revisions, yet in the process of doing the revisions, the original one comes out. That's where it's on the edge for me.
I'm not sure if it's appropriate if I could say, just to clarify something, Dr. Bojanski.
I'm sorry, Dr. Mastikian, this is a time for deliberation only.
And I think that the date-wise, the complaint was in 9 of 20. The revision was done in 9 of 19. So a couple months after the previous interaction with the board. So that's what Dr. Scali reviewed. So I think the original consultation was revised. It just didn't get transmitted to KP. And I don't know how it necessarily would have, regardless. But I don't see this as a response to the current allegation. The revision was done before.
So he was already doing what we would have expected him to do, in fact, fixing that language in such a way that it would be more appropriate. And in the process of doing that, KP was not informed that it was fixed, did not see it, even though the fixed one was what was used in the court evaluations and formal process. She was feeling aggrieved by the original, which was in fact revised and not used in by the formal court evaluators.
Yeah, I mean, I'm speculating here, but the problem though is that original one showed up in May of 2019, and I think that's what started the ball rolling. And yeah. And yes, it was fixed, but the damage had been done.
The original one was used in court in the summer of 2019.
Right. So I think I need either procedural or legal advice here. Procedurally, can we resolve this prior to it going to the board? Not a dismissal, but like a what's the non...
A letter of concern is non-disciplinary, but the only authority the committee has is to dismiss, to ask for additional investigation, or refer to the board. You can refer to the board and make a recommendation for a fill in the blank.
Okay, thank you. So I guess that's the route I'm leaning to, is that we would refer this to the board with a recommendation of a non-disciplinary letter of concern.
Because I see support of that, Dr. Meyer.
All right, then I'll make that my motion.
And I'll second it.
All right, there's a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion passes.
Do you, just to clarify, if it's being forwarded to the board, does the committee need to cite potential violations?
Yes, please. But if it's a letter of concern, that's the recommendation. But if they feel that there could be potential violations, you should let the board know what provision.
I'm comfortable with just referring it with the recommendation for a letter of concern.
Well, I mean, do we need to say like it's a violation of A16 or, I mean, the basis for the letter of concern would be some kind of unprofessional conduct, I would assume.
Yeah, based on the discussion, I'm inferring that the concern was that Dr. Mistikian drafted this consultation summary without having evaluated KP and solely was informed by ex-husband. If, as far as notice is concerned, can you talk to me about a possible violation so they have some sort of notice for the board?
So I would see it as 16DD for an ethical standard under the APA 9.01, the basis for assessments.
And while the committee is not recommending that, there was some this was discussed during the committee meeting. I think that would be sufficient.
Good.
So that was my motion.
All right, and it was seconded. All of those who voted in favor of the motion, do you support this clarification of the motion?
Yes.
Yes.
I actually don't support the clarification. I apologize. So I'll change my vote to no, but I know the motion still passes.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. So moving on to the last.
Mr. Chairman, may we have a 5-minute comfort break, please?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Let's have a 5-minute comfort break. We should come back at... All right, it's 10:15. Let's get back from the break. So the last item on the agenda, or the last complaint on the agenda rather, is complaint number 20-10 for Michael Epstein. Dr. Meyer, since you're the lead committee member for this complaint, would you please provide the committee with an overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So quick question for everyone. Do you want me to read through everything or just the kind of point out the highlights from the timeline that was submitted this morning? Any preference from people?
I think, I mean, all of us have read the material, so maybe just brief overview for the record.
I'm not entirely sure that timeline submitted this morning is accurate. There was no mention of the revocation of the privileges. So I might recommend that you go from the investigator's report.
Okay, I will try to pare it down as much as possible, but be a bit more thorough. All right, so in December, just a second. In December 2015, the board received a complaint 15-47 from AL, who was an enlisted service member in the Navy who received therapy from Dr. Epstein from 2014 to 2015 at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. AL alleged that at her last therapy session in July of 2015, she had sex with Dr. Epstein, and as a result, her mental health deteriorated. AL reported the information to the Navy less than a week after the alleged occurrence, and the Navy initiated an investigation. In June of 2017, the board received correspondence from Dr. Epstein's lawyer indicating that the Navy had cleared Dr. Epstein from all charges and that the court-martial case was closed. However, the information did not specifically state that there was a dismissal of criminal charges. In request to the board, we then received an email from a Navy lieutenant, which indicated that allegations of sexual misconduct were unsubstantiated and that the court-martial charges were withdrawn. However, in the CSC review in April of 2018, the CSC committee voted to dismiss the complaint, noting that if any action was taken by the Navy in the future, that Dr. Epstein shall notify the board. In September of 2019, the board staff received an email from the National Practitioners Data Bank, which indicated that there had been an adverse action report filed against Dr. Epstein by the Navy's Bureau of Medicine and Surgery on September 2019. This indicated that the Navy's decision to revoke Dr. Epstein's clinical privileges occurred approximately 2 months after the CSC dismissed the complaint. The date listed for the action from the Bureau did not report it to the data bank until one year later in September of 2019, as Dr. Epstein had appealed the decision. A final decision regarding the appeal was subsequently issued in September of 2019 to revoke his clinical privileges. As previously mentioned, the CSC meeting stated that if any action was taken by the Navy, Dr. Epstein was to report it to the board, which he failed to do upon receiving notification that his clinical privileges were revoked. And in the renewal from September of 2018, Dr. Epstein's license renewal, which occurred 3 months after being issued the letter that his privileges had been revoked. Dr. Epstein noted in his application that there had been no change of status in the review, that it was the same complaint from over 3 years ago. The case just had not been closed and no further action had taken place. So Dr. Epstein did not disclose on his 2018 renewal that the Navy had revoked his clinical privileges or that he had appealed the decision. On the next renewal application that was submitted in September of 2020, Dr. Epstein's answer to the same background question was same investigation from 2015, no new allegations, no closure. He did check that yes to the question that he had relinquished responsibilities, resigned from a position, or had been terminated since the last renewal period. The board, after receiving the information from the data bank in September of 2019, voted to open a complaint 20-10, this current one, for further investigation. Additional information was requested. Further outlining the Navy's findings, but that after appealing that the revocation of clinical privileges stood. And this included the information about the appeal that said, that said it stood. In October of 2019, Dr. Epstein responded to the new complaint. In which he noted that this is the this has all been the same case that he had previously reported, stating that the case had not been closed and no further action had taken place. Dr. Epstein's response is that he is unaware of any evidence of any violation of a statute or rule on his part in the matter. And he requests that the complaint should be dismissed. He is currently on active duty in the Navy as a lieutenant, serving as a licensed clinical and forensic psychologist. However, in an email from Dr. Epstein's representative, stated that he is not currently practicing psychology under his Arizona license. And I'm going to say that concludes my summary of the findings.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. Ms. Michelson, whom do we have signed in to speak on this matter?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as the committee indicated, the complaint was opened by the board in 2019, so there is no complainant present today. It is Dr. Epstein along with his two attorneys, Mr. Carver and Ms. Stark. Before we do hear from them, I just wanted to clarify a couple of things and note that yesterday, Mr. Carver had sent me a timeline indicating that it addressed the Navy's proceedings for Dr. Epstein's case. I did forward that to the committee today. The timeline did not appear to address all of the proceedings regarding the revocation of clinical privileges. So I just wanted to indicate that a Navy hearing panel was held in April 2018, shortly after the CSC meeting. At that time, the hearing committee panel recommended to revoke his clinical privileges based on substantiating the allegation of sexual misconduct with this client. He was issued a notice in June of 2018. Dr. Epstein did appeal that decision. And in 2019, he was noticed that the Navy had upheld that decision to revoke the clinical privileges. At that point, the Navy then reported the information to the data bank, which then I became aware of. I did also ask Mr. Carver when I received the timeline for him to clarify Dr. Epstein's current status in the Navy. I know he indicated he's still on active duty, but it's not aware of the current capacity that he's working in the Navy since he his privileges have been revoked. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Good morning, Dr. Epstein, Ms. Stark, and Mr. Carver. Would one of you want to make a statement? If not, then the committee members might have some questions to ask Dr. Epstein or one of you. You may proceed.
Yes, I have. Thank you. This is Jeff Carver. I, been requested to make an opening statement, and I'd like to do so at this juncture. First off, I'd like to thank the committee members for taking the time to consider this complicated case. At least from the government's perspective, it's complicated. And I'm going to urge you to either dismiss the complaint or at least not refer to the full board now. And I'm going to explain that a little bit later. The overarching characteristic of this case in the Navy is that it has more twists and turns than a large bowl of spaghetti. To a military justice scholar, it might be an interesting case study in military justice, military procedure, military medicine procedure, et cetera, et cetera. But for the practitioner like myself on the front line, and for the professional himself, Dr. Epstein, it's really not that complicated. His privileges have been, whether you call it revoked, terminated, suspended, whatever, they have been non-existent since July 29, 2015. That's 5.5 years ago. Nothing has changed. Those privileges have been non-existent. The commanding officer on July 29th, 2015, terminated, suspended. He used the term suspended. They were suspended, and they haven't been, that suspension hasn't been rescinded, modified, or otherwise. And in terms of what Dr. Epstein has been doing in the meantime, let me just get to the bottom of that right now. And I truly appreciate Director Michelson having sent me an email and suggesting I address this question. The answer is he's been doing nothing. He literally has been doing virtually nothing. He initially got a few little assignments way back in 2015. And he would report to work a few hours a week. And he'd get a little assignment. But it was busy work. And over time, given permanent change of station orders that other service members, other officers are getting, all his colleagues changed. I don't think anybody at the Naval Hospital even knows him now. If he shows up, he wouldn't be recognized. He has been reduced to working at the hospital about 4 hours a month, 4 hours a month, where he goes, checks his mail, checks what's going on to the extent he can. He doesn't see any patients. He has not seen any patients since July 29, 2015. He's doing nothing. He's getting full Navy pay. He is a commissioned officer. He's getting that pay. He's getting his professional pay. So he holds himself out as a psychologist, and he gets the pay for that. But he doesn't do that work. He hasn't done that work. So the answer to that one is simply nada. He's just doing nothing in his profession. He's just treading water in the status. Okay. Now, to me and to Dr. Epstein, his status hasn't changed because regardless of whether he wins or loses hearings in this process, nothing happens. That's why I prepared the chart. Now, I noticed, and I appreciate this, and it was an issue I struggled with a little bit. I think Attorney Galvin and Director Michelson mentioned it as well. I didn't include the last BUMED revocation. It's true. I didn't include it because the chart was intended to be a list of, in chronological order, of the evidentiary hearings, which one might consider investigations. I'm not necessarily sure you should, but if you were going to call them investigations, that's fine. It wasn't necessarily meant to explain all the rulings and or the final determinations based upon recommendations from these hearings. So that's why I didn't include it. There's no doubt that BUMED now has said your privileges are revoked. They use that term, except that the case is not closed. And I'll explain that in a moment. So we go down this chart and you'll see in the win column, we have about 10 wins. And in the loss column, we have one. But regardless of whether we won or lost, the privileges remained suspended. So that takes us to the complaint. The complaint, the gravamen of the complaint appears to be that Dr. Epstein did not admit or convey or explain, how's the board put it? He was asked whether you are the subject of any investigation by a professional organization or government. And he said, this case has not been closed. No further action has taken place. And he said, same as previous renewal, which is 100% accurate. There has been no final determination. And he explained, and that is important because when Dr. Epstein says the case is not closed, he's telling you really more than you've asked. He's trying to be complete and accurate and say, hey, it's still up in the air. There are still things happening. He doesn't go into depth about what those things are because, you know, you could get lost in the weeds if you heard all that's happened in 5.5 years. He just said, hey, it's still pending, which was true. And his privileges were obviously still suspended. But by indicating case not closed, he was putting the board on notice that, hey, bad things could happen, bad things might happen, good things could happen. I don't know. So the reason I ask the board to consider either dismissing the complaint, because it's the answer that Dr. Epstein gave on his renewal application was accurate, or not forwarding the complaint this time, is because you'll note by the last thing on the chart, as of February 21st of this year, Navy Personnel Command issued notification that there would be a board of inquiry. Now this finally is a big deal. All these various committees and quality assurance reviews and peer panels, et cetera, okay. But as compared to a board of inquiry, they're nothing. A board of inquiry is what Admiral Halsey went to for his mistake in Typhoon Cobra back in World War II, where he lost 790 men. That is an important proceeding. It's supposed to occur within 60 days of the notice. February 21st was the notice. It can be extended by 30 days on order of the convening authority. It still hasn't happened. So the Navy in this case, and that's why I said the twists and turns it's taken in 5.5 years is unbelievable. Here we are with the Board of Inquiry pending and the Navy hasn't even followed its own timeline. But regardless, when we finally get to that Board of Inquiry, we will have a full-fledged evidentiary hearing. We wish we had had it back in 2016 when there was a general court-martial pending, but those charges were dismissed. So now we finally got what is kind of second to a general court-martial, a Board of Inquiry, where the question will be, was there misconduct? If so, should Dr. Epstein be retained or separated? And if separated, what should be the characterization of his discharge?
And Mr. Carter, okay. Can you clarify what the Board of Inquiry hearing is for? In a correspondence to me, you indicated this is strictly an administrative matter and it does not concern his clinical privileges. So can you clarify what that is for then?
Sure, I appreciate that. In the Navy, you have the criminal side of military justice court-martials, which the results can be confinement in the brig for life. There's even a death sentence possible in the military. And a reduction in rank and forfeitures of pay and a number of different punitive measures, including a bad conduct or, bad conduct discharge. Or a dishonorable discharge. You so rarely see those. That's the ultimate punishment that it's hard to even remember them. That's the criminal side. Now, that part of this case, Dr. Epstein's case, went away back in July 15, 2016. Court-martial said, no way. There just isn't enough evidence here. Okay, so we didn't get our day in court then. A board of inquiry is on the administrative side. On the administrative side of the house, the Navy looks to see whether an officer committed misconduct, if so, whether he should be kept or retained, and or if he's separated, what should be the characterization of his discharge? And there are three characterizations available: honorable, general, under honorable, or other than honorable. But there's no punishment by way of confinement, no death sentence, no forfeitures, no fines, nothing other than these three administrative decisions. I did one of these on Monday. Some misconduct was found, but the board said it's not significant enough to warrant discharge. And that was that, we won the case. Now, Lieutenant Epstein's case, if we ever get to this hearing, which I don't know why it's been so delayed, but it'll happen eventually, I hope, we'll be able to present all our evidence, a full investigation package, live witnesses, board members who are naval officers, senior in rank to Lieutenant Epstein, probably two captains instead of commander, and that board of inquiry will decide whether there was ever misconduct. Now, if that board of inquiry, where you finally had a full-fledged evidentiary hearing, comes to the conclusion that there was no misconduct, I'm not sure how they're going to unwind this 5.5 years and all the twists and turns that have occurred. I honestly don't know. But at least it will be either the end or it wipes all that other stuff out. So that's the best I can do in explaining how we are where we are presently. We are in the administrative side of the Navy's procedures. This Board of Inquiry does not address clinical privileges. It's not concerned with client welfare or patient welfare. It's only concerned with how Dr. Epstein has performed his duties as a naval officer and whether he's committed misconduct or not. And so will this affect ViewMed's decision? I don't know. It hasn't, nothing has affected his status ever. And that is privileges suspended, privileges revoked, privileges terminated, whatever you want to call it. He has not been able to see patients under either an Arizona license or any license for 5.5 years. And I don't know what's going to happen if he should win the board in terms of what we're going to do with that 5.5 years. But in any event, that I hope that helps explain our status.
Mr. Carver, this is Jean Galvin, the board's attorney. I have one question. If this notice of the board inquiry went out in February of 20, have you contacted them about the status and any possible timeline when this inquiry will be held?
No, and I'll tell you why. The respondent, Dr. Epstein, has only one option when he gets one of these notifications. He can request an additional 30 days delay. That's it. There's no other requests he can make. He just has to appear before the board and present his case, show cause why he should be retained. That's the standard that the board is looking at. It's a show cause authority back at Millington, Tennessee, Naval Personnel Command that says, okay, you show us why you should be able to stay in the Navy. We're not allowed to ask anything else like, hey, what the heck happened to your board of inquiry? We're, 10 months out, you said it was supposed to happen in 90 days. What's going on? And the reason we're not allowed to do that is because it's in the chain of command. And the show cause honcho in Millington, Tennessee, he's obliged to direct some command here, whether it's Commander Naval Base Southwest or Commander Naval Hospital Balboa or whoever, to get this underway. And that's not our problem. In other words, we're not required to urge them on. We're not allowed to urge them on. That's way up the chain of command. That's way above our pay grade. They do it when they choose to do it. Of course, with COVID-19, everything has been delayed. But I'll note, the Board of Inquiry I did Monday, the notice came out 75 days ago. We asked for a 30-day delay. We asked for a continuance into next year because of the COVID. They said, no, we're going to all meet, and we did. That's the only thing you could do. Yeah. The COVID did not delay that board at all. I made 4 separate requests for the continuance. I wanted it more than 30 days, but I am allowed to ask for a continuance. Every one, including the one made at the board on Monday, was denied. Okay, that's the way it is. We went forward, we won. That's fortunate. But in at this juncture in Lieutenant Epstein's case, all we know is there is a notification. We are the low man on the totem pole here. We have no authority to go up and say, hey, get your board of inquiry going. We're sitting out here getting paid and getting pro pay and doing nothing. We'd like to change that. Well, we're not allowed to say that.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Epstein or his attorneys?
Yes,
Dr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Dr. Epstein, thank you for being here. I guess my question is, back when the previous complaint was dismissed, when we were notified that, sorry, I lost my date there. So we were told that the court-martial charges had been withdrawn. And then we dismissed the complaint, in April of 2018, noting that if any action is taken by the Navy in the future, you shall notify the board. Did you try to notify us that anything had changed, since what we were aware of was that the case had been dropped and there was nothing else going on in the investigation? It wasn't until for licensure renewal that you said, oh, this case is still going on.
Sure.
May I address that? On behalf of Dr. Epstein, and I'll turn it over to him if he still wants to say anything, if it's okay.
Please.
I think if there's blame in that regard, it's probably mine. I'm to blame for not understanding the board's desire that I keep them apprised of the ongoing procedures. I didn't do that, frankly. I thought we were done, and I just knew there was going to be more procedures and we'd handle those as they came, and I crossed that bridge when I came to it. But in my mind, I just wasn't thinking in terms of, oh, we better let the board know. Okay. That's partially.
Well, I wasn't present at that time, but the way that it appears is that you implied that this case was dismissed completely, not that there was ongoing, that privileges remained, clinical privileges remain suspended, that there was ongoing investigations. It's that the information we received was that the allegations of sexual misconduct were unsubstantiated and that the court-martial charges were withdrawn, and that the case was dismissed.
And to clarify, just to give a brief timeline, it's my understanding that the court-martial criminal charges were withdrawn in 2017. That information was provided to the board. The CSC reviewed the prior complaint in April 2018. At that time, they dismissed it, but indicated there are any further actions taken by the Navy that Dr. Epstein is to notify the board. Shortly after that CSC meeting is when the Navy hearing panel took place, and they substantiated the allegations of sexual misconduct. They notified Dr. Epstein that they would be revoking his clinical privileges. He subsequently appealed that decision. 3 months after his appeal, he then submitted his renewal application, as noted in the report. He did not indicate what had transpired. Then a year later, the appeal was reviewed and they decided to revoke the clinical privileges, that decision was final. And then we received notification from the data bank. At no point were we notified that this had transpired.
Well, I think there's a couple of points there that I should address. First off, what I said about the court-martial proceedings was absolutely accurate. The charges were dismissed. They later were called withdrawn. Then they were called dismissed again. They were gone. Whatever you call it, they were gone. The Navy isn't real formal about how they dismiss charges. They're real formal about how they charge people. When it comes to dismissal, they draw a line across the charge sheet and write a handwritten dismissed as of this date. You can't even read it. It's very informal, but it works. It's called pen and ink changes. That's what the Navy's procedure is. And I represented that accurately to the board. I considered the investigation to be to have been closed when NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service, finished its investigation. I have that investigation. It was done. It was finished. There wasn't anything more to investigate. Now, that was the criminal side of the house, but the investigation was used on the administrative of the house side of the house for these various hearings. But I did not consider the hearings the equivalent of investigations. I looked at them as evidentiary hearings to make recommendations based upon the investigation that had been done. So yeah, I think it's a little bit of a matter of semantics, but you know, we lawyers try to be exact as we can. And sometimes I'm wrong. I thought this was not ongoing investigation. I still not necessarily would agree it was ongoing investigation. There were administrative procedures on the privileges side, the administrative side, and those kept going on. And frankly, I didn't always understand them. Dr. Epstein had to explain it to me because I don't always do matters in the medical field. And when this went back to BuMed, I got on the phone with them and talked to their lawyer, gosh, probably once a month, saying, you know, how is this supposed to turn out? Are you going to help us out and explain what's going on here? And they would say, don't sweat it. I think you're going to be fine. And, you know, we thought we were going to be fine and finally came down. I was quite shocked, frankly, got the news when I was on vacation that, oh no, we're going to revoke his privileges. Okay, well, then that's that in terms of the privileges.
But then we were not notified of that either. It wasn't until the databank report was submitted that we learned of these final decisions. And so, nor did you notify us about that change.
Well, I don't think there's a change there. There was a final decision on the recommendation of the fair hearing panel.
So not change, final decision that clinical privileges, it's a change from suspended to revoked. Those clinical privileges were revoked. We weren't notified of that. Why is that?
Right. I'll tell you why. Because at least from this practitioner's perspective, we're still in the same boat. There are no privileges, whether you call them revoked, suspended, terminated, whatever you want to call them. There are no privileges. He hasn't been practicing. He hasn't asked to be practicing. He's still status quo. Now they're revoked. What difference does it make, frankly? Because if the Board of Inquiry says there's no misconduct, are his privileges going to be renewed? I still don't know. But we seem to be finding these words of art, which the practitioner and the doctor really don't appreciate, quite honestly. Suspended, revoked, terminated, rescinded, whatever you want to call the privileges, they haven't changed. And so you're filling out the application and they ask you, what's your status? Well, it's the same. So in terms of answering the application, is accurate. In terms of our obligation to keep the board apprised of ongoing proceedings, well, in that regard, if anybody failed, it was me. I apologize. I'm sorry about that. I honestly didn't.
Dr. Carver, may I ask you a question? It seems to me that under federal statutes, the 111133, I am a bit confused as to why this matter was reported to the National Practitioner Database to begin with, because I think it doesn't satisfy the federal statutory requirements to have put that notice in the national database to begin with. And that's the trigger that started all of this process at the Psychologist Examiners Board here in Arizona. So could you please speak to that and clarify how it got into the database?
Can I speak for a little bit? Is that okay?
Sure.
Dr. Epstein, because I have never understood why it was reported, and he may be able to explain it.
Is that okay with everyone? Thank you. First of all, I apologize if you see me getting up every so often. My 3.5-year-old is home with me, so I have that I appreciate being able to meet with you. I understand that this is a volunteer position that you guys are in, and really, I don't see why you would take this position if it wasn't for to uphold the integrity of the profession as a whole. And I think that's what this comes down to, is integrity. To put it in perspective, I'm just one lieutenant in the military of thousands. And the Mueller report, something we are all familiar with, lasted 675 days total, something that impacts everyone in this country. My case is now going on 1,947 days. That's unheard of. The amount of information sent to you is unheard of. The fact that this would be sent to the national board is unheard of at this point. I've gone through 5.5 years of not being able to practice and do the job that I love for something I never did. And the fact of the matter is it has been one suspension after another, but a continuance. And can I ask a brief question? Does anyone on the board have any experience with the military or understanding of the military and how it works? No?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't.
I mean, in terms of active duty and understanding how the mental health profession works in terms of when a charge is brought up against someone, because I can give a brief understanding because it's very confusing to everyone, including active duty and civilians. So I just want you to understand the process versus having to either side jump to a conclusion. Does that make sense?
If the committee members feel that's necessary, then you can listen to him. If you believe it has no bearing on whether he engaged in unprofessional conduct, then we can move on to another question.
Well, I think, I mean, in terms of what would be helpful to me when I'm viewing the record, it is that as Mr. Carver was mentioning, I mean, if the investigation, prosecution, whatever you want to call it, at the Navy is still ongoing, my concern is there isn't any final agency action taken by the Navy at this point. So there is nothing to report really, but the report was made for whatever reason to the National Practitioner Database. And that's really the reason why this complaint is being investigated on the board's own initiative at this board. I would be inclined to dismiss this complaint if you, for whatever reason, convince me that this should not have been reported to the practitioner database to begin with. And we can just wait for, you know, the machinery, the administrative apparatus at the Navy to take its course. And once they reach some administrative final decision, we can maybe revisit this case at that point. So that's why, I mean, factually speaking, I want to find out why we are here essentially. And the partial answer to that, as far as I see it, is that there's a report in the National Practitioner Database.
And Mr. Diner, just to clarify, a final decision has been made with respect to the clinical privileges. Now, it's my understanding that the Board of Inquiry that Mr. Carver is referring to is regarding his retention in the Navy. So the clinical privilege aspect, that has been finalized, and that's why they waited until 2019 to report that, because it was going through the appeal process for a little bit over a year, and then they upheld that decision, and then it was reported to the databank. So I think with regards to the retention in the Navy service, that is a separate issue not related to this here before the committee today.
May I just interject? That is partially true. However, the first question that the Board of Inquiry will be obliged to answer on a findings worksheet is, was there misconduct? If they say no, then this whole process is going to have to be unwound. We're not just talking about retention or separation in the Navy. We're talking about whether there actually was misconduct. From the beginning, there was no misconduct substantiated. Throughout a number of proceedings, there was no misconduct substantiated. One panel found there was, resulted in Bumez's decision, but regardless, as we've talked about, the privileges has been suspended.
So the privileges have been suspended in 2015 or thereabouts. And
July 29th, 15.
Right. And that went through the appeal process. And that was the subject matter of the previous complaint. So nothing. So your position is nothing has changed in that respect.
Right. And they really weren't appealed.
And we found out about the National Board submission the same time you did. I was given an email that it had been submitted to the National Board. Mm-hmm. I was not made aware of that prior to it being submitted to the board. So when you found out, or when the board found, National Board found out, is the same chain email that I found out as well. And to be quite honest, yes, I have legal representation. I didn't know that if the legal board is also being made aware, because they specifically stated that that would also be going to Arizona. I didn't know that there was a change there that I was supposed to do further action other than that as well. It wasn't that I found out weeks or months earlier from this.
So then my question is, was the 2015 suspension based on the court martial that was eventually dismissed?
I think Mr. Diner might be helpful to refer to page 49 of this file. When the client had filed a complaint with the Navy regarding the sexual misconduct, they notified him that he was not able to practice. It was suspended until the investigation was complete. And as Dr. Epstein has commented, it was ongoing for several years. So I would refer to page 49.
So within the Navy, as long as a allegation is made, it doesn't matter what the allegation is. The rule of law is that you are placed on suspension no matter what, and that occurs before the investigation even begins, if that clarifies that.
Yes, that's helpful. Thank you.
And I think also one of the concerns that Dr. Meyer noted in the summary was with regards to his 2018 renewal application. He did not indicate that the hearing panel's results or that he had appealed the decision. It was a very general response. And I know that was part of the concern that I did notate in my report.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Epstein or his attorneys? Dr. Bohansky, if you're attempting to speak, you're unmuted.
I'm getting used to this on and off button here. Doctor, how much longer are you in the Navy?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
How much longer are you in the Navy?
My commission, I've completed my commission 2.5 years ago, and I have been forced to remain active duty through this process. I am in until they say I am not. I have completed all the requirements to get out of the Navy, but because this has gone on for 5.5 years, and it's still ongoing, I don't have the capacity. I'm not allowed to get out yet until all administrative actions are completed. It's pretty much like being in purgatory at this point. I think the simple answer is no charges have actually come across me in 5.5 years. Nothing has changed in 5.5 years. And if I genuinely did something wrong and they believed I did something wrong, I can almost guarantee you that I would have been court-martialed or given a dishonorable discharge at this point. Because that goes against everything that the Navy stands for in terms of honor, courage, and commitment.
Thank you. That was my understanding as well.
Sorry, hold on. Sorry about that. 2 minutes.
The doctor is locked in a position in the Navy where he can't practice. He can't practice outside of the Navy.
Correct.
So he's not practicing psychology at all. Is that an accurate statement?
Unfortunately, it is.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I'm ready for discussion.
All right. Any further questions? Hearing none, let's move on to deliberations. As a reminder, this is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without any interruptions from the licensees or the attorneys representing the licensees. So Dr. Meyer, do you want to kick it off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there's clear lack of accurate communication from Dr. Epstein and his attorney with the board. It's unclear to me if that's because of, if that was intentional or if that was just kind of the unclear status with the military procedures and findings. I'm comfortable with, I do not feel comfortable dismissing this complaint, but and since he's not practicing and we haven't renewed his license, I'm fine with postponing this until the Board of Inquiry actually does happen. And since he's not practicing, he's at a standstill right now, and we see what the final outcome is from the board, and then we can make a decision.
I'm in a similar situation. I am very frustrated by this case. I recall it years ago when it first came up, and I was hoping our military procedures were more competent at getting some type of resolution. I think it's unfair for us to act when there's an outstanding question at the practice level, at the military level, at the employer level, if you will. I'd like to see that resolved, and then we act from there. I'm frustrated that National Practitioner Data Bank got involved. Normally, that's an automatic. I'm frustrated that we weren't notified by doctor or his attorney. But as doctor noted, this is an unusual scenario, and he was told Arizona would be noticed, and Arizona was noticed. We're aware of it. He does not have an active license here. I think we hold on any renewal or any action on this until this Board of Inquiry is finished. At very least, its first part. Whether he stays in the Navy or not is the second part. But the first part is, did doctor do something egregious? Did he do something wrong? And if the first part of that inquiry comes out that way, then I would be looking to do something at our end.
If I may, his license is active because he timely submitted a renewal application. And his Arizona license will remain active until this board adjudicates this underlying complaint.
Right, I understand that.
Okay, and you do have the question of one, whether there was inappropriate, unprofessional conduct. And then you also have the question of he was truthful on his renewal applications. And I don't know if you want to consider bifurcating the matter. You could table this issue for possibly 6 months and have a check-in to see if the Board of Inquiry has met or taken any sort of action, with a direction to Dr. Epstein and his attorney to notify the board immediately with any updates that the Navy has taken, and deal with whether there's a misrepresentation on one or more applications and not wait on that.
Yeah, I would lean towards what Dr. Meyer and Dr. Bohansky were suggesting, is to kind of put the case in some sort of holding pattern with us and then have Dr. Epstein update us if there has been any substantive change in the ongoing matter at the Navy Board of Inquiry. If there is such a change, then based on that update, we can then put that on the next complaint screening committee agenda. I don't think this needs to go to the full board yet, just because it's in a very preliminary stage. We haven't even done, you know, our substantive review, and that review is going to be in a holding pattern until we hear back from the Navy in this regard. So I would be leaning in that way, and I think Ms. Galvin's suggestion makes sense to me in terms of not dismissing the case and kind of keeping it in that holding pattern.
Procedurally, can we keep it? I mean, if he doesn't go before the Board of Inquiry for another year, does it matter how long it stays on our docket?
It does, in the sense that you cannot investigate or open a complaint that's more than 4 years old unless it involves sexual misconduct, which this would fall within. But if it goes on too long, you would lose jurisdiction over whether he was truthful on his renewal application. And I would suggest that instead of just relying on Dr. Epstein and Mr. Carver to notify the board when something happens, that there be an affirmative directive that they notify us or update us in 6 months, regardless what has happened.
I like that. The communication here has been very poor, and it's unclear to me whether it was intentionally misleading or not, which is what I'm concerned about for the dismissal of the previous claim. That's the big concern here, because if I'm assuming that if the complaint screening committee had known that clinical privileges were still suspended and this was still being reviewed, they wouldn't have dismissed the claim. So the way that it was conveyed of charges being dropped and withdrawn or whatever, that concerns me quite a bit, because that claim should have still been in a holding pattern as well.
I'd like to just clarify that for you, because there are two tracks in terms of military. There's the legal and the administrative. And our meeting, the one in 2018, fell in between the two. Of the legal has to occur prior to administrative. They don't happen concurrently, which that is stupid for so many reasons, but they don't. The legal...
That your clinical privileges were still suspended should have been broadcast at that point, or that was missed. What, regardless, when I read this, the way it comes across is that the entire case was dismissed. So it's perhaps a misunderstanding of the military procedure. However, the way it was conveyed is that this case was done, and it wasn't until the next renewal that you say, oh, this case is still pending, which the communication was not sufficient. So I'm willing to just kind of wrap that up into the total case. I don't know that I want to separate them, but I like the idea of active reporting of the status every 6 months until there's until the Board of Inquiry is completed.
And I'm fine with that.
I'm sorry, Dr. Epstein, this is a time for deliberation. I appreciate your comments, but we need to stick to the process we have. In terms of Ms. Galvin's point regarding the 4-year statute of limitations, I think if we keep the case open, it's still an ongoing matter with us, and the date of opening this complaint kind of serves as the date for statute of limitations purposes, unless I'm mistaken. Ms. Galvin, please correct me if I'm wrong. In other words, I mean, keeping the case open or keeping the case closed matter in terms of the four-year statute?
I think there's an argument that the complaint has been open, it's under investigation, and that would toll any statute of limitations is a plausible argument.
Right, I mean, that was my thinking, and I think that's why keeping the case in a holding pattern kind of makes sense to me in that regard.
I think if there's a directive from this committee to have Dr. Epstein and his attorney actively report every 6 months, but I would say at the 12-month mark, we should bring it back to the committee and take another close look at this. And I would suggest or at least request that I don't think that Dr. or Mr. Carver at least make an inquiry of the Navy about possible timing. I think you would certainly have the right to do that. I understand, you know, you're the process and woman on the totem pole and whatever, but I also think you have an interest in the Navy getting paid, having to do very little work. So you may be satisfied with the status quo, but I would think you would at least have the ability to make an inquiry as to a possible time when this is going to go forward.
The other issue is that Dr. Epstein's license is staying active. I mean, I understand that he's not practicing in the military, but he's also not spending much 4 hours a month. Would he be able to practice outside of the military at this time if we were to leave the license active?
No, is the short answer. You need to have the Navy's approval in order to do any form of clinical work outside of your profession, outside of the Navy.
Is Ms. Galvin, is there a way to put the license on inactive status at this point?
He could request that it be put on an active status, but because there's a pending complaint, that's not how the board typically operates.
Oh, okay.
And I assume that what he has stated is correct, that he could just not come back here and open an active practice.
All right. Then I would make a motion that we
table.
Thank you. Table this review until the Board of Inquiry is complete, with the stipulation that we are given a thorough report of the current status of the cases in all forms every 6 months. And that we revisit this case in the CSC in 1 year.
I like the second part of your motion. The first part of your motion saying that you would like to table this matter till the Board of Inquiry finishes its review.
Okay, so I'd like to table it for a year. Okay. With a report at 6 months and 1 year for us to review the status of this case. An earlier notification if the Board of Inquiry is completed.
And leave of the CSC to take it up at any intervening time should the facts require it.
There you go.
I'll second the motion.
All right, there is a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion passes. So moving on to item number 5, adjournment. Is there a motion to adjourn? Thank you, by the way, Dr. Epstein and Mr. Carver, Ms. Stark.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
There is a motion and a second to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The meeting is adjourned at 11:15 a.m. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks. Bye, all.
Thank you.